Ruth Ann Jones, and I'm one of the organizers of the Library Colloquia Series. On behalf of Libraries Computing and Technology, I'd like to thank you all for coming tonight and to welcome two people, our speaker, Dr. Michael Kimmel, and first, Dr. Maxine Baca-Zinn of MSU's Department of Sociology.
Thank you. Every year in early spring, women and men in the academy and in communities all across the nation celebrate activities that enlarge our visions of history. In February, we celebrate Black history, and in March, we celebrate women's history. So it's fitting that at MSU, as we move into April, we begin with a visit and talk by one of the most distinguished pro-feminist thinkers in the academy. I'm pleased to do this introduction. And yet, in some ways, our speaker needs no introduction. Not only is the name Michael Kimmel familiar, but his name and his work are a daily word in college courses across the nation. As a pioneer in the study of men and masculinities, Michael Kimmel, for over two decades now, has been making the case that feminism is for men as well as women. His many works on men's encounters with feminism have carved out a whole new terrain for us, and they've given us new tools for rethinking men's lives. In a very short time, Michael Kimmel's books have become classics. I guess I could comment on any one of his, I'm not sure how many books you've written, 10 or 12, but three stand out for me. The first is his book, Manhood in America, published in 1996. This is a study of the masculine mystique from the early days of the Republic to the present. This is the definitive study of how masculinity in our society has changed through history. The second book that I'd like to point to is, some would say, his most controversial book, and I think I would agree with this. Published in 1995, it's called The Politics of Manhood. Pro-feminist men respond to the mythopoetic men's movement. But my favorite Michael Kimmel book is his book, Against the Tide, published in 1996. This is the untold story of men who have supported feminism. And in this way, it's a vital part of women's history. I should probably also mention his very influential anthology that he co-authored with Michael Messner called Men's Lives, because probably most everyone in our student audience has worked with this book. It's a very popular collection here at Michigan State. Now in its fifth edition, it's one of the most popular gender texts in the entire country. Of course, this is only a small sampling of the very large body of work Professor Kimmel has produced that is now indispensable in doing gender studies. He's the founding editor of the new journal, Men and Masculinities. But how, we might ask, did this man, how did he take up feminism? I hope he tells us how he took up feminism. I read that it was first sparked during his undergraduate years at Vassar, where he was a member of the first class of men to graduate from that institution in 1972. Dr. Kimmel earned his PhD from the University of California, Berkeley in 1981, and he's since been a visiting professor on campuses from coast to coast. When he returned to Berkeley in 1992 to do a stint as a visiting professor, he received the Best Professor Award, an honor that is highly unusual. In introducing a speaker, it's customary to highlight their formal achievements, but there's another side to Michael Kimmel that should not go unnoticed. And that is his mission to apply his work beyond the academy. In other words, his mission to be a public intellectual. He does this by writing for dozens of magazines and newspapers, including the New York Times Book Review, the Harvard Business Review, The Nation, The Village Voice, The Washington Post, and Psychology Today. Professor Kimmel is also the national spokesperson for the National Organization of Men Against Sexism. He runs workshops for public sector organizations on preventing sexual harassment and implementing gender equity. He also runs workshops for campus groups on sexual assault, pornography, and the changing relations between women and men. So his influence is wide-ranging. Suffice it to say that at the turn of the century, we simply couldn't do pro-feminist work without the advances forged by our distinguished speaker. gives me great pleasure to present to you this evening Professor Michael Kimmel.
Thanks, Nancy. Yikes, what an introduction. Virtually no way I'm going to be able to live up to all of that. If I just turn one of these microphones off, it'll probably... All right, so I'll keep this one on. Well, let me tell you a little bit what I'm going to talk about. I mean, you know, my first thought was, you know, well, thank goodness Women's History Month is over. You know, now we can get back to 11 months of men's history again. It does always seem to be the case that in that little joke, actually, there's a big theoretical argument that I'm going to be making tonight about what we mean when we name something Women's History Month, and we assume that the rest of the year is something else, and what that something else is doesn't get mentioned, and some of the politics of what doesn't get mentioned. What I'm going to do tonight, I think the first thing I want to do is explain a little bit the title of the talk I'd like to give to you, a title that has been evolving over the past decade or so as I've been going around to college campuses and talking to students and giving lectures and whatnot. And basically, it's trying to get a sense of a handle on some of the ways in which male-female relationships are being renegotiated on college campuses around the country. So this is really a talk geared mostly to the students in the audience. And to try to figure out what it is that we're grappling with and why. Now, the title started, actually, some of you probably figured out a little bit about it from the names that were included. The title of the talk begins in October 1991, when Clarence Thomas is being confirmed for the Supreme Court. And if you remember back to October 1991, when a lot of people were just sort of transfixed in front of the TV set watching this unfold, if you remember, after the way that the Senate Judiciary Committee treated Anita Hill when she came forward to talk about what had happened to her, if you remember, the media had one phrase that they used to describe this. After the shameful way they treated her, now we've been recently reminded about the shameful ways that Senate Judiciary Committees can deal with people. Do you remember the phrase? It was a chilling effect. This was going to have a chilling effect on women. Women are going to be less likely to come forward to talk about sexual harassment. Women are going to be less likely to come forward to talk about what happens to them in the workplace. Well, the first question I have is, have the media ever been more wrong? Because not only has there not been a chilling effect, there's been a kind of national thaw. Women have come forward in unprecedented numbers to talk about what happens to them in the workplace. When that event happened, I was doing my visiting professor stint at UC Berkeley and wrote an op-ed piece. You know, and winning that award, I have to say, just as an aside, what does it say to you about the quality of instruction at a university where a visiting professor who walks in one semester wins the award for best professor? In any case, I sat down and wrote an op-ed piece for my local paper, the San Francisco Chronicle, called Clarence and Us. I said, okay, guys, sexual harassment's now been put on the table. We've got to deal with it. We've got to address, what does it mean for us? How should we think about this? So I wrote this little op-ed piece, and somebody read it at a local college and invited me to come give a talk based on that little op-ed piece a few months later. So I said, sure, I'll come give it. So that talk happened about 4 months later, and that talk was entitled Clarence William Iron Mike Magic and Us. Because by that point, 4 months later, there were three new names in the news that we all had to start talking about. William Kennedy Smith, who'd been accused of date and acquaintance rape, Mike Tyson, who'd been accused of date and acquaintance rape, and of course your own Saint Magic, who had acknowledged that he was HIV positive because, and these were his words, because he had accommodated over 1,200 women. So I figured we ought to talk about that, too. Now, that is the background. Tonight's lecture is entitled Clarence William, Iron Mike, Magic Spur, Posse, Tailhook, Woody, Senator Packwood, Citadel OJ, John Wayne, Babbitt, Aberdeen Training Ground, Marv, Iron Mike again, Luttrell, President Clinton, and us. Now, the very fact that I cannot get through the title of my talk without stopping to take a breath gives you an idea that over the past decade, there has been a steady stream of men whose names are familiar to virtually all of us, who signify, to my mind, some of the flashpoints in the relations between women and men, some of the renegotiation of gender relationships on campuses and in our society. So what I want to do is I want to try to talk about those names in some kind of groupings, as you'll see. Now, I am a sociologist, and sociologists often, you know, public speakers often, you know, sort of supposed to lead with a joke. Well, you know, sociologists, if you've ever been in a sociology lecture, we like to lead with data. So I brought some. And what I'm going to read to you, actually, these are results of two polls, two surveys that were done by the Roper Organization, one in 1970 and one in 1995. And in each of these surveys, they asked 3,000 American women, fairly well sampled for race, region, age, class, all across the country. They asked 3,000 women what they thought of men. So what you're going to hear, of course, is the differences between what they said in 1970 and what they said 25 years later in 1995. In 1970, two-thirds of the women said that men are basically kind and considerate. You're not supposed to say it's not supposed to think it's funny yet. In 1995, 47% thought so. 1970, 41% of the women surveyed said that all a man wants from a date is to go to bed. 1995, 55% thought so. 1970, 42% believed that men were basically selfish and interested only in their own opinions. In 1995, 58% thought so. 1970, 49% believed that men's egos require that they put women down. 1995, 55% thought so. Finally, 1970, 39% of the women surveyed believed that men are basically only interested in their work, not really interested in their families. 25 years later, in 1995, after two decades of The Cosby Show, The New Fatherhood, the first Cosby Show, 54% of the women surveyed said men were only interested in their work, not really interested in their families. So the question that strikes me is, what's going on here? Could it be that men are doing worse in 1995 than we were doing in 1970? I already see a couple of heads going, no, that's not it. That's not it. And of course that's not right. I don't think that that's what it's measuring at all. I don't think it's measuring whether or not men are doing better or worse. I think what it's measuring instead is a transformation of women's lives over those 25 years. Women's lives have changed so fundamentally that their expectations about men and their perceptions about men have changed dramatically. Now, what I'd like to do then, because I think this sets the context for us, is I'd like to point out some ways in which women's lives have changed over the past 25 or 30 years, and then use that as the context to talk about why and how those relations between women and men are being renegotiated today. Now, I'm going to point to four areas in which women's lives have changed. The first area of change in women's lives, and this is so obvious, I barely need to say it today, is that women made gender visible. We now know that gender, like race, like class, is one of the basic fundamental experiences of social life, one of the basic building blocks of identity. This is relatively new. 25 years ago, there were no women's studies programs anywhere. The first women's studies program was begun in 1972 at San Diego State. It's all within the past 25 or 30 years that we have now known that gender is such a central part of our experience. If you went to graduate school in the early 1960s, for example, if you went to graduate school in sociology, we knew class. By the mid to late 60s, we began to know race. But if you went to graduate school in sociology in the early 1960s, there was one course you could take that would even talk about women's experience. It was called Marriage and the Family. For years, that was kind of the ladies' auxiliary of social science. Now, of course, there are women's studies programs and women's studies courses on every college campus in the country, including, I might report to you, I was asked by the Justice Department to be their expert witness on masculinity in their cases against VMI and the Citadel when those schools were trying to exclude women. And so, of course, we did site visits down to Citadel and VMI. And there in the Citadel, long before Shannon Faulkner shows up, mind you, there at the Citadel in Charleston, South Carolina, 9 a.m., there's a women's studies course being taught. Two cadets sort of sleepily sitting there in the room. But there it was on the books, even at Citadel. Today, there are women's studies courses everywhere. That's a dramatic transformation. Women did that, made it visible. That's the first change. The second change in women's lives has been around the workplace. Now, I also teach at a large public university, so very often I teach very, very, very large courses. I don't know what kind of class size you have here for your courses, Maxine, but at Stony Brook, I teach, for example, a course called Sexuality and Society to about 420 students in the largest lecture hall we have, you know, a course on intimacy. And so very often I have my students raise their hands, you know, when I ask them different opinions, and it gets very, you know, so they can see graphically how they sort of line up on different issues. So let me ask the women in the room who are students here. Let me ask you a question. How many of you expect to have full-time careers outside the home when you get out of college? Raise your hands. Now, keep your hands raised if your mother has or had a full-time job outside the home for at least 8 years without an interruption. Grandmothers. Okay. Non-farm family great-grandmothers. Anybody know? Now, what you see here is exactly what I get with my students. Virtually every woman's hand goes up when I ask whether you're going to have a job. When I ask about mothers, 2/3 of the hands are up. When I ask about grandmothers, about 1/3 of the hands, fewer actually in this room, fewer than 1/3. Now, what would happen if I asked the men that question? You know, how many undergraduate men expect to have full-time jobs outside the home when they get out of college? Well, of course, the question's absurd. Every hand would go up, and it would stay up for fathers and grandfathers, basically until we hit the Great Depression. Because men's relationship to the workplace hasn't changed nearly as much as women's relationship to the workplace in the past 25 or 30 years. It's just in those two generations that it has changed that fundamentally. The third area of change, of course, is derived from that, and that is the relationship between work and family. Women now want to be able to balance their workplace lives and their family lives. They used to feel that they had to make a choice. They had to choose between work and family. Now, you don't have to believe me. Read Katharine Hepburn's autobiography if you want to see a really good example of this. She says, you know, she really wanted to be a famous actress, and she knew that. And so when she got out of college, she said, I know I can never get married. I know I can never have children. It was an agonizing choice for her, and she made it, and she never looked back. Today, women, of course, you remember that phrase it was a very Bush-era phrase. Can women have it all? Can women have exciting, glamorous careers outside the home and warm, loving, supportive families to come home to when they came home? And of course, the answer was no. The reason that women couldn't have it all, exciting careers outside the home and the loving, supportive families to come home to, was because men did. Men were the ones who had the careers outside the home and the warm, loving, supportive families to come home to because women were doing the second shift at home. So men were having it all, and that was, of course, the reason that women couldn't. That arena of change has been an area where women have been trying to negotiate how to balance work and family in a way that makes sense for them. And of course, as you'll see as I continue, that has raised a lot of issues for men. The fourth area of change in women's lives is around sexuality. Now, this is the hardest one for men to wrap our heads around, because we figure that we're the great sexual revolutionaries, the great sexual pioneers. And, you know, I mean, what was the sexual revolution? More access to more partners with fewer commitments. I mean, that's the most masculine sexual script you'll ever find, right? So it is really astonishing often to take a look at the research that has been done on human sexuality in America over the past, say, 30 or 40 years, and notice that it is women's sexuality that's changed, not men's. Now, the easiest way to summarize how women's sexuality has changed over the past, say, you know, 30 years or 40 years or so is women now claim their own sexual agency. Women can like sex, can want it, can go for it, can get horny. All of these things are relatively new for mainstream American women. It's certainly relatively new in mainstream discourse about women's sexuality. Let me give you two measures of this from mountains of sex research that one could look at. You know the great studies that Alfred Kinsey did, 1948, Sexual Behavior in the Human Male, Sexual Behavior in the Human Female, 1954. What he found in 1954 was 42% of American women over 25 had ever masturbated to orgasm. Now, in 1996, the National Opinion Research Center at University of Chicago published a book called Social Organization of Sexuality, in which they did the first major study since Kinsey that was well sampled, a major representative survey of American sexual behavior. They found that 88% of American women had ever masturbated to orgasm. Now, that is a dramatic transformation in sexuality. Now, what's masturbation, after all, but claiming sexual agency, the right to be pleasured, you know, by yourself? Now, what would be the comparable change for men? Sexual behavior in the human male, 1948, 96%. Social organization of sexuality, 1996, 97%. So, as you can see, there's not a tremendous amount of change in male sexual entitlement to pleasure. Let me take it from the other side, not entitlement to pleasure, but willingness to conceal it. 1975, Lillian Rubin did a study of white working class women in the San Francisco Bay Area and published his Worlds of Pain. Marvelous book. In that book, she found that, now brace yourselves, this is social science, so you know social scientists can only think in four categories, a lot, some, a little, or nothing. So she found that about 40% of the women that she interviewed in 1975 said they sometimes or more often faked orgasm. 40% sometimes or more often faked orgasm. Now, a few years ago, about 3 years ago, she went back to that same neighborhood and interviewed, again, a sample of working class women. This time, many of them, the daughters of the women that she had interviewed 20 years earlier. This time, she found fewer than 10% said they ever faked orgasm. Another way that you could really measure, gauge a dramatic change in women's sexuality and their right to pleasure. I have no comparative evidence, you know, data on men faking orgasm, so I can't really give you a kind of baseline comparison there. But you get the idea that women's sexuality has really changed dramatically over the past 30 years. So those are the four arenas that I want to discuss that are changes in women's lives: making gender visible, workplace, work and family, and sexuality. And now, so while this colossal change has been going on for women, what's been happening with men? Well, the easy answer, I think, is to say not a whole lot. I don't think that's quite accurate. I think that the world now is completely different for men. Our lives have changed dramatically. I'll give you just one illustration. My father went to an all-male college, served in an all-male military, and spent his entire working life in an all-male work environment. That world is completely gone. There are only 3 colleges that are all-male left in America. There is no all-male military any longer. And there's virtually no occupation where you won't have a woman colleague, a woman coworker, or a woman boss. So the question really isn't whether or not men's lives have changed. They have. The question is, how have we thought about our lives in response to this colossal change? And there, I think, what we bump up against is not the transformation of our lives, but rather the inelasticity of the ideology of masculinity. I think most men are still wrestling with a very traditional idea of masculinity that derived from a very different world. The psychologist Robert Brannon once came up with the 4 basic rules of manhood. And they're very, very simple, and you can sort of, if you are a guy and you're having some doubts or questions about masculinity, if you were to memorize these, just keep to them all the time, you too could be a real man. And they're very simple. The first rule, probably the most important rule of all, is no sissy stuff. You can never do anything that even remotely hints of femininity. Your masculinity is the relentless repudiation of the feminine. That's the first rule. Everything else is really just an elaboration of that. That's really it. The second rule of manhood is be a big wheel. We measure masculinity by the size of your paycheck. Wealth, actually I think it's bulges. Bulging wallets, bulging crotches, bulging biceps, bulges are masculine signifiers. Wealth, power, status. You remember that Reagan era phrase, he who has the most toys when he dies wins? I should tell you that I'm an adult child of psychoanalysts. I'm in recovery, sociology, I think. Every time I say that phrase, I'm always afraid I'm going to say, he who has the most toys when he wins dies. Anyway, that's the second rule, be a big wheel. Third rule of manhood, be a sturdy oak. What makes a man is that he's reliable in a crisis. What makes a man reliable in a crisis is that he resembles an inanimate object. A rock, a tree, something that does not ever show its feelings, ever break down, ever admit vulnerability. The fourth rule of manhood, give him hell. Exude an aura of daring and aggression. Always take risks. Live life on the edge. Go for it. So those are the 4 rules, and if you can ignore the internal contradictions, obviously, among them, you too could be a real man circa, say, 1955 or so. There was actually one man who did manage to keep up with these four rules every split second. You know, they do these polls every year. Who are the American men you most admire? Now, the top 10 change every year. There's virtually no name on it this year that was on it last year. It's unbelievable how quickly they change. There was one man in American history who dominated those lists for 30 years. The entire decade of the 50s, 60s, and 70s, one name topped that list every single year, the American man we most admire. And who was that? You know, John Wayne, of course. The only man who fought in every war in American history. except I might add, any real ones. He actually avoided military service. Now, you knew it was John Wayne. Did you know what his real name was? That's right, Marion. Marion Michael Morrison was his real name. Marion Michael Morrison. And he gets to Hollywood in the 30s, and he wants to act in the genre picture of the era, which is gangster movies. He gets an agent, says, I want to act in gangster movies. His agent says, not with a name like Marion. We got to make, you know, we got to give you a real manly name. Now, what could be more manly than two first names, each of which has one syllable? You know that real men like one-syllable names. Now, in my youth, it's possible to get away with two syllables if the second syllable is an E sound, like Mickey or Willie. But that's about it. So they reinvented it. Now, I don't know if many of you know much about John Wayne, but aside from the fact that he avoided military service. Now, John Wayne was a big man. He stood 6'3 and a half. And yet, in his early westerns, John Ford used to position the camera. Now, the standard was to position the camera at shoulder height and shoot straight on. But with Wayne, they wanted to make him look a little bit bigger than even his 6'3 and a half frame. So they positioned the camera at about belt height, and they projected him up just a little bit larger than all of the other characters. You know those great saloon scenes where he's sitting at a table in a saloon? His table and chair were smaller than everybody else's. It made him look so big that he couldn't even be accommodated by a normal-sized table and chair. Right? And you probably also, those of you who know anything about John Wayne, knew that it was John Wayne, do know that he was afraid of horses, hated them. Just thought I'd mention that. So even he was a fiction. And yet for 30 years, he dominated the polls as the American men most admire. Now, what I'd like to do is I'd like to take those four arenas of change in women's lives and those four rules of manhood and pair them up and see why it is, I think, that we're facing the kinds of issues that we're facing today on campuses and in our society across the country. Now, the first arena of change, remember, is that women made gender visible. Now, the problem here, however, is when we hear the word gender, we think women. When we teach courses like psychology of gender or sociology of gender, we typically get between 2/3 and 4/5 women. When we hear the word gender, we think women. It's as if men don't realize that men have a gender, that gender matters for men. Now, I think there's a politics to this. I don't think it's just simply, well, we haven't gotten around to figuring it out yet. Some of you may be familiar, having looked at some of my work in the past, with a story, with something that happened to me that I tell about how I began to think about these issues. It wasn't that long ago. When I was teaching at UC Santa Cruz in 1980, those of you who know Donna Haraway's work, she had just shown up on campus as a professor that year. And in her honor, before she even started formally teaching, she organized this little study group on feminist theory with a few graduate students and a couple of faculty members who were interested. So 12 women and me decided we would sort of sit around and read a work in feminist theory each week and get together and talk about it. And in one of those sessions, I witnessed a conversation between two women that really kind of changed my view of this. Those of you who know your history of feminism will recognize this as a very 1980 or so, late 70s, early 80s conversation. So bear that in mind. A white woman was saying, all women face the same oppression in patriarchy. All women are similarly situated in patriarchy. All women have a common oppression, and therefore all women have a kind of intuitive, natural sisterhood. A black woman said, I don't know. The black woman said to the white woman, when you wake up in the morning and you look in the mirror, what do you see? And the white woman said, I see a woman. And the black woman said, you see, that's the problem for me. Because when I wake up in the morning and I look in the mirror, I see a black woman. To me, race is visible. But to you, race isn't visible. You don't see it. And then she said something really quite startling. She said, that's how privilege works. Privilege keeps the terms of your privilege invisible. You don't see it. Now, remember, I was the only man in the room, and I kind of groaned like this, and somebody said, "What was that reaction?" And I said, "Well, you see, when I wake up in the morning and I look in the mirror, I see a human being. I'm kind of the generic person, universally generalizable. I'm a middle-class white man. I have no race, no class, no gender. I'm kind of every man." And I like to think now, I think back to that moment as the moment that I became a middle-class white man, that race and class and gender weren't about other people, but they were also about me, and I had to start thinking about them. And I had to start thinking about the privilege that kept them invisible to me for so long. Let me give you another illustration of that privilege, of how that invisibility works. How many of you have email? How many of you are on email? Let me see your hands. Now, how many of you have ever written to somebody in another country? What do you notice about their email addresses that are different from yours? Which is a country code, right? You want to write to somebody in Japan, you write .jp. You want to write to somebody in Germany, .de. You want to write to somebody in South Africa, .za. You want to write to somebody in the U.S., .nothing. That's what hegemony looks like. For and community, yeah, in community colleges. Only community colleges have a .us. As far as I know, everything else is .edu. Now, if you write to somebody in Australia, it's .edu.au, right? Because only the United States doesn't have a country code. When you are the dominant power in the world, you don't have to be named. You're unmarked. Everybody else is named, is marked. Only an American could sing with sincerity, "We are the world." That's what hegemony looks like. You don't see it. It's embedded in the naming. Who gets named and who doesn't? Now, I think there are real consequences of this invisibility. Remember, the first rule of manhood is no sissy stuff. Now, let me give you a couple of examples of that invisibility and how it works out. Some of you may remember a few months ago the brutal murder in Laramie, Wyoming of Matthew Shepard. Now, in this particular case, what I'm going to read to you is an article actually from the New York Times about the men who murdered him. And not to flog my own discipline too much, but what the New York Times does is, of course, they go out and find an expert who in this case happens to be a sociologist who studies gay bashing crimes at UC Irvine. Now, what I'm going to read to you is a paragraph of the article. The first part is the sentence written by the New York Times reporter reporting the data. The second is a quote from the expert, and you'll see how masculinity or how an analysis of gender disappears. The Times reporter states the facts. Young men account for 80 to 90% of people arrested for gay bashing crimes, according to this expert, a sociology professor at UC Irvine. Now, this is her quote. "This youth variable tells us they are working out identity issues, making the transition away from home into adulthood." Did you hear it disappear? The Times reporter says young men account for 80 to 90%. Then she says this youth variable. Or, for example, think about the way, I mean, now, had it been 80 to 90% women, young women, don't you think gender would have been at the center of every single analysis? Don't you think it had it been women that had walked in, that had opened fire in Paducah and Pearl and Jonesboro, that gender would have been at the center of every analysis? We wouldn't have been talking about Southern culture and gun culture and father absence and all that stuff. Don't you think it had been women at Michigan State last week who were doing all those burnings, that gender wouldn't have been at the center of every single analysis? Certainly the national news coverage, which is the only coverage I saw, was all guys. Not a word about masculinity, not word one. Student culture, alcohol culture, oh, those Midwesterners, oh, how sad it is when schools are so sports obsessed and then they lose. Not a word about masculinity. Had it been women, don't you think every analysis would have been about women? That's what invisibility is like, and it's what keeps us, I think, from really understanding some of these issues. Now, remember, that again, this first rule of manhood, no sissy stuff. Without some mechanism in our culture to let boys feel safe and secure and confident in their masculinity, without making masculinity visible, I think what happens, and one of the things I try to write about in Manhood in America, is that masculinity kind of becomes a relentless test. You're always having to prove it. It's always up for grabs. It always has to be demonstrated. It starts when we're very, very young. I'll bet you I could walk onto a playground here in East Lansing, where there's about five or six-year-old boys happily playing together. And I could start a fight by asking one question. Every guy in the room knows what question. Who's a sissy around here? One of two things is going to happen. Two guys will go at it. He is, no, he is, no, he is, no, he is, and they'll have a fight. Or all of them will go, he is, he is, he is, right? And that little boy is going to have to either fight them all or he'll run home crying, which kind of proves their point. This starts very, very early in our lives. And it goes, and it haunts us for a very, very long time. I mean, imagine the most secure guy that you can imagine here at Michigan State. The guy who has absolutely no problems about his masculinity, the guy who has absolutely no, you know, completely okay about it, nothing to prove to anybody. Let's pretend he's not in the room. And now he walks in, and I say, what a pussy. And you say, yeah, probably a faggot. And you say, yeah, what a wimp. Now, what's Mr. Cool and Confident doing? We're suddenly transformed into a scene from Taxi Driver. You're talking to me? You're talking to me? We could call him out like that. And since one of the most poignant moments, I think, I wish I could say it just stops when you get out of college or something, but in fact, to my mind, the most poignant moment in the history of American masculinity, I was reminded by this at the Academy Awards, it was when Jack Palance got the Academy Award. Remember this, 1992, for City Slickers for Best Supporting Actor? Do you remember this? Jack Palance, 75, gets to the podium, picks up the Oscar, and says, I'm really glad to get this award, because, you know, a lot of Hollywood producers thought that I was over the hill and that I couldn't do it anymore. Puts the Oscar down, drops to the set of the stage, the floor, does a set of one-armed push-ups, gets back up, picks the Oscar up and says, and I can still get it up. And I thought to myself, actually I didn't think to myself, I said out loud, when does it end? When do you get to sort of kick back and relax and just not have anything to prove anymore? This idea of proving it haunts us all of our lives. Without some way that we can let men feel confident and safe and secure in their masculinity, it seems to me that this proving it is a constant theme. And one of the most interesting things that I've seen recently, I'll just mention this quite briefly before I go on and just touch on the other areas, that strikes me as interesting is, you remember, Carol Gilligan's really important work on adolescent girls, where she says that when girls hit adolescence, their self-confidence and their self-esteem just takes a nosedive. And what she says, her way of summarizing that, is that girls lose their voice. You remember this phrase that she uses? Girls lose their voice. At one point, they're doing just fine, and then suddenly they hit adolescence, they hit junior high school, and bam, they lose their voice. Well, what some of the most recent research on boys is showing is that at that same age, boys gain their voice, but it is an inauthentic voice. It's an inauthentic voice of posturing and bravado and risk-taking, and the voice that they lose is that little fearful voice of vulnerability and fear. And they never gain it back. And some of the therapeutic work that's being done with young boys now is to try to get them to reclaim the authentic voice that was so fragile and so frightened that they completely covered up because they were so afraid of being seen as sissies. So at the same time women lose their voice, boys gain one, but it's an inauthentic one. Let me move on quickly to talk about a couple of the other issues. The second area of change in women's lives is the workplace. The second rule of manhood, be a big wheel. And I think here we have several issues to deal with. One of which is that it is much increasingly hard in the global marketplace to be a big wheel. Men's economic status as breadwinner, as provider, I don't have to tell people in Michigan, in a city that has an auto plant after all, that it is much harder to be a family provider and a breadwinner than it was in our father's and grandfather's generation. It is much more tenuous. Men's economic hold is far, far more tenuous than it was, say, 20 years ago. And the evidence is all around us. The actual family of four income, the median income for a family of four in the United States, measured in constant dollars, is exactly the same as it was in 1973, within about $3 or $4 of what it was in 1973. Now, what's the big difference between a family of four in 1973 and a family of four in 1998, which is when that's right. So it really does, in fact, take two incomes to provide what one income provided just a generation ago. So now, remember, men's economic status is more and more tenuous, their hold on being a breadwinner, just at the moment when women are entering the workplace in unprecedented numbers and they're not going away. I remember in 1989, George Bush's Secretary of Labor suggested that if women would just get out of the workplace and go back home, we would have 0% unemployment. Do you remember this? Right? If they would just leave and go back home, we'd have 0% unemployment. Now, of course, women did not heed that call. They haven't gone back to the workplace. And of course, this is the structure. Now, what I'm trying to suggest to you in a way is this is what I think of as the political economy of sexual harassment. Now, this is the structural arena in which sexual harassment is taking place. I'm not talking about quid pro quo sexual harassment. I'm not talking about the sexual harassment in which, you know, you sort of say, sleep with me and you'll get a good grade, or sleep with me and you'll get a promotion, don't sleep with me and you'll flunk, don't sleep with me, I'll fire you. The quid pro quo stuff is slightly different. What I'm talking about is the hostile environment. The hostile environment where you remind women that although they may be in the workplace, they're still just women. Where you remind women that the workplace is still a male arena. That it's still a place where men go and women, by our grace, may or may not show up. We make them feel uncomfortable because it's a public arena, and we reclaim it as our own. So this is part, I think, of why sexual harassment has become such a major issue all over the places. It's probably the single focus in the workplace, in workplace land. It's the single focus for men's anxieties about losing their workplace status as single breadwinner. And they have a very convenient and easy target on which to put it. But I think it's quite clear that the hostile environment is a way to make women feel uncomfortable, to get women to be less than their best in their working environment. So that's one reason I think we're facing this issue all across the country, and not just on college campuses, not just in some corporations and not others. The second area of change, a third area of change in women's lives, again, is balancing work and family. And the third rule of manhood, be a sturdy oak. And here I think we're facing a lot of different issues. The very things that we thought would make us real men, the cool confidence, the refusal or unwillingness to show any emotion whatsoever, is precisely the thing that is now inhibiting us from doing the things that we say we want most, which is to be good fathers, good partners, good friends. The very qualities that are required to allow men to be the kind of fathers that we say we want to be is exactly the qualities that are in shortest supply among sturdy oaks. Alan Alda once said that a man isn't someone you'd want to have around in a crisis, like raising children or growing old together. And it seems to me that, I mean, how do we think about how we think about work and family in this country and balancing work and family, or to how we think about these questions of fatherhood. We think we have this great discourse in America about quality time. You know, let's spend quality time together, you know, which usually means throwing a pass with Junior at halftime on a Saturday afternoon. But I don't believe in quality time at all. Any of you who have ever been in an intimate relationship know full well that you don't schedule intimacy. Intimacy is something that happens when you put in all the boring long hours of doing what I advocate, which is called quantity time, right? Intimacy, you know, it's like, you don't say to somebody, honey, 8:30 Saturday night, we're going to get close. I mean, it sounds like a deodorant ad, doesn't it? I mean, it's all wrong. You know that that's wrong. But I believe in quantity time. I believe in doing that. What nurturing and caring and loving really is about is doing all the really boring, really repetitive tasks that nobody writes a book about, that nobody goes on talk shows to do, you know, that basically the routine stuff. To speak as a sociologist for a moment, nurturing is not a mystical state of being. It is a set of practices. It is something that people do in their relationships with one another. I don't believe that one learns how to nurture by going off into the woods and chanting and bonding. I believe one learns how to nurture by doing the stuff of nurturing. That is to say, by washing dishes, by doing laundry, by changing diapers. That's what nurturing looks like. It's boring, it's repetitive, and nobody notices. Now, it seems to me that's the thing that's going to allow men to have the lives we say we want. Now, here's the final sort of big political theme that I want to introduce tonight, which is for us to have the lives we say we want. Now, this is something that is true of American men all across the country, regardless of race, class, region, is American men say they want to be good fathers. They want to be really involved fathers. They want to really be caring about their kids. Now, the things that's going to enable us to do that is sharing housework and childcare. That's quantity time. That's putting in the hours. So the very thing that made us feel like we could be real men is the very thing that now inhibits us from being the kind of fathers that we say we want to be in the first place. So here's a place where women's demands that men figure out a way to share housework and childcare is exactly the blueprint for how men can have the lives we say we want to have in the first place, which is to say, really close relationships with our children. So if we want to have those kinds of relationships, we've got to figure out a way to support support our wives' efforts to balance work and work and family, and also to do it ourselves, not to pitch in, not to help out, but to actually share housework and childcare. Now, let me say that this is not just a psychological question. This is not a lifestyle option. This is also a public policy issue. This is not just, okay, me and my wife, we'll do it this way. We'll share it, it'll be okay. Currently, despite the Family and Medical Leave Act, currently we have three reforms that go under the umbrella heading of family-friendly workplace policies, right? On-site childcare, flex time, and parental leave. And as you know, these are offered sporadically, a little bit, and unpaid to a large number of American women. Now, how do we think about these issues as women's issues, right? They're not women's issues, they're parents' issues. To the extent to which men begin to identify themselves as parents, we are the ones who are gonna have to say, we want on-site childcare, flexible working hours, and parental leave, because we wanna have those kinds of relationships with our children. Now, I would say politically, women probably won't get these unless men start demanding it as well. But it's also true that we won't be able to have the kind of lives we say we want without these things. Let me give you some, just a quick little comparison. We talk a good game in this country, but we expect individual men and individual families to figure it out for themselves. Not so in Norway or Denmark or Sweden. There, women get 11 months of parental leave at full pay. At the end of the 11 months, she goes back to work, and he gets an additional month, which in Norway and Sweden have the cute title daddy days, and the daddies have an extra month, which they can't give away, right? If they don't take it, their wife can't take it, right? They have to be, they can take an additional month with their kids. At the end of that full year of fully paid parental leave, each grandparent gets 1 month of paid grand parental leave. That's family values. Those are cultures that value children so much that they put a lot of resources into supporting families staying together and being involved with their kids. Not like here where we say, well, we want everything like that, but you have to figure out how to do it all by yourself. You will get absolutely no support from us. In fact, we're going to make it even more difficult for you. So that's a public policy issues, it seems to me, not simply lifestyle choices by individual men and individual men in relationships with individual women. Okay, last issue. Last arena of change for women is sexuality. And the last rule of manhood, give them hell. Good sort of thumbnail definition of male sexuality. Sort of go for it, always go for it. Now, here I think we face on every college campus probably two issues that you've all had to deal with at some point or another in your collegiate career. But we don't think of them, we don't talk about them in the same breath, and I wanna talk about them together. And they are HIV and AIDS on the one hand and date and acquaintance rape on the other. Now, usually we don't think of these as similar, but I wanna talk about some of the similarities between them, or better put, some of the similarities between them and this rather inelastic, resistant ideology of masculinity. Let me take HIV first. Now, I'm going to say something here. Please remember, I do know that women are at risk for AIDS. It is true that women are at risk for AIDS. Not only that, but from unprotected heterosexual intercourse, women are more likely to contract HIV than men are. And women represent the largest growing population of HIV patients in the country. Okay, you got all that? I've said all that. 92% of all people with AIDS in the US, Canada, and Western Europe are men. It's the most gendered disease we've ever had in our history. This is not a sex-linked disease, not like hemophilia, not like prostate cancer, which attacks only one biological sex. This is a disease that could affect both sexes equally. In fact, from what I just said, is more likely to affect women than men from unprotected heterosexual intercourse. And yet rarely, if ever, is masculinity an issue in the way we talk about it? We talk about virtually everything else. Now, how do we think about the way to prevent the risk from HIV? You probably all got some flyer in the mail, you know, sort of little how to prevent HIV when you first came, you know, from the health service. Now, what's the best way to prevent the spread of the risk for HIV? Abstinence, right, abstinence. Right, now, this is the first response is abstinence, which may be an okay individual lifestyle choice for some people, I suppose. But as a public policy issue, for college campuses, I don't think it's going to be effective. And the reason for that is simply demographic. This is you will never, if you're a college student here today, you will never be in another place for the rest of your life with more sexually active, unmarried people. You know how your parents said, like, these are the best years of your life? That's what they meant. I mean, colleges and universities are sexual hothouses. I mean, you gather all these people together, they're all sexually active, virtually none of them are married. And then you say, oh, by the way, abstain. Oh, sure. Now, that's why, of course, abstinence is not probably a public good public policy strategy, although it may be a good individual strategy, depending on one's moral position. But it does seem to me that safe sex is the default position, all right? Practice safe sex, at least. Do some things, don't do other things, and if you do some things, only use condoms. Now, what's the problem with safe sex is that safe sex to men is an oxymoron. You know, an oxymoron is a phrase where the terms cancel each other out, you know, like military intelligence or business ethics or social science. Sorry. What's sexy is hot, passionate, explosive. What's safe is warm, soft, cuddly. I mean, those must be the most detumescent words in the English language. Sexy is the exact opposite of safety. So in effect, what safe sex campaigns do is they ask men to stop having sex like men, which is, of course, not going to be a very effective strategy, which is a place where I think heterosexual men bump up against homophobia. Because if you look at the gay male community's response to the HIV crisis, that is exactly what they have done. They have said, let's make sure that we keep safe sex sexy, that we eroticize safety in such a way that we can still let sexuality be an arena where men can confirm their identity as men. So there's safe sex videos and safe sex clubs and safe sex everything. And if straight men weren't so homophobic, we could learn so much from the gay male community's response to HIV. Because what they've done is they've figured out a way to eroticize safety, to make responsibility and safety part of one's sexuality, which is exactly what heterosexual women have been asking men to do for decades around birth control, is to make responsibility part of one's erotic vocabulary. That issue of safety, it seems to me, is the link between HIV and AIDS on the one hand and date and acquaintance rape on the other. Because after all, remember I said that the big change in women's sexuality is that women feel entitled to pleasure. But the difference between women's sexuality and men's is that safety is a precondition for sexual agency, for finding their sexual voice, for expressing their sexual autonomy. Safety is a precondition. Women have to be certain in the center of their being that no means no, that their boundaries will be respected, that they won't be disrespected, that men won't try to get over on them. So it seems to me that women have to be certain that no means no before they can figure out what it means for them to say yes. What do I want? What do I want to do? What do I want to be done with me? Now, it seems to me then if men are honest when they are saying, and this is a big leap of faith, I grant you, but let's just take men at their word. Men say they want to be with women who are hot and passionate and excited about sexuality as they say they are. If that's true, that men want that, then the best way to get access to those kind of women who are in touch with their sexuality as we think we are is to support women's efforts to end date and acquaintance rape. Because only when women are not afraid that their safety is going to be abridged will they even have the remotest possibility of finding out what they themselves want sexually. So if men are being honest about it, that is a leap of faith, I grant you, that we want women who are passionate, exciting, and all that in touch with their sexual voices, then it seems to me that the best way to do that is, in fact, to support women's efforts to end date and acquaintance rape. Now, of course we should support women's efforts to end date and acquaintance rape because ethically it's the right thing to do. We should also support it because a lot of men feel like it gives us all a bad name. I mean, what is it? Doesn't it make you feel insulted? Doesn't it make you feel ashamed that women that you know are afraid to go out with you or guys that you know? It ought to make us feel ashamed. So, of course, we come at it from a sort of a moral position or a position of shame, but also from a position of a positive motivation, which is to say we can have the relationships with women that we say we want to have if and only if we support women's efforts to end date and acquaintance rape. So that really is the big, to my mind, payoff here. What I've been trying to argue is that feminism offers a blueprint for challenging, for critiquing, for undermining those traditional rules of masculinity. But rather than being defensive or resistant to it, what feminism actually offers us is exactly the blueprint we've been searching for all along. The one that will allow us to have the kind of relationships with our children that we say we want to have, with friends that we say we want to have, with our partners that we say we want to have. That feminism offers men a loving critique of traditional masculinity and holds out the promise that men can actually change. Now, let me just say one final word and then end and invite your questions. It seems to me that feminism gets a very bad rap when we say that feminists are male bashers. You've heard this phrase, right? Now, it seems to me that the real male bashers in our culture is the right wing. There's no question about it. The right wing says, and you don't have to believe me, read Charles Murray, read George Gilder, read all these right-wing theorists. They all say the same thing. Men are basically lustful, rapacious beasts. And if women don't control us, we will be wreaking havoc everywhere. Now, how is that women's fault? Because you left the home and went out into the workplace, you abandoned your natural role to constrain men. Since feminism happened, men have been running amok. It's women's fault. Your job's to go home and then constrain us because naturally we're just violent, rapacious beasts. That's male bashing. That believes that we are nothing more than those beasts. Feminism, by contrast, to my mind, cares about men so much to believe in us, to believe in our possibility of change. The right wing doesn't believe that. They believe the only way to control men is for women to leave the workplace and go back home and constrain us by, of course, listening to Wendy Shallot, by holding out. Sort of the large-scale cultural Lysistrata is basically what we're looking at here. Men won't fight with each other because we're too busy sort of begging and pleading with women to give it up. Now, one thing I'll say, Maxine mentioned one of the books that I did several years ago, Against the Tide, which is a documentary history of men who supported feminism in America. Now, before you get the idea that this must be the world's shortest book, it's actually a really big, fat book. And the reason that I made it a really big, fat book was exactly for that reason, because it seemed to me that it was so easy to say, there's never been men who supported feminism. And what I found was that there have been hundreds of men who supported feminism. Every struggle in American history that women have been struggling for equality, from education to the labor force to the right to join unions, the right to serve on juries, the right to vote, there have been men who supported them. In doing the research for that book, I found one document that really spoke to what I'm trying to suggest to you tonight. It was written in 1917 by a writer in Greenwich Village named Floyd Dell. He's a fairly famous novelist. And in one of the pamphlets that he wrote in 1917 for a magazine called The Masses, he said the following. This is the first line of his essay. Feminism will make it possible for the first time for men to be free. Thanks very much. Now, I'm hoping that we have some time for questions, comments, discussion, up to you. Yeah.
Feminism. Take it to the masculine. Is there even a word? I didn't know it. I know feminism. I don't know what the equivalent is. I just thought that was interesting. Something to think about.
Sure.
You guys, your 4 points. I'll let you.
Yeah. Okay. Go. Sure. Sure. Go for it. No, I don't go at nothing. If you're gonna do more than one, I'm gonna write it down.
Okay.
I'll take notes. You took notes, I'm taking notes. Okay.
Second one was, we had these 4 points that you contrasted, and a lot of them that had to do with this stereotypical male gender role,
right,
of being the macho guy, that seemed like a lot of those are related to not, to me, I thought, a lot of the thing that you talked about in conjunction with that was related to capitalism and biblical, so that carries through a whole bunch more stuff than just 19th century,
mm-hmm.
and that if you relate it.
Right.
You know, whatever. That, how many, I'm not wearing a shirt so you can see my little bulges, but how many, I found this through my observation that many of the women, and I'm not saying this is a generalization, I'm saying from my observation, I found that many younger women, because I'm a younger guy, seem to go for the guys that have the bulging wallets, that have the bulging crotches, and the bulging muscles.
Mm-hmm.
And so, being someone who wants to express his feminine side and feels very confident about that, in terms of dating, that does not make me attractive to females.
Yeah.
And I noticed that, and I have to deal with that.
Let me at least respond to some of this, right, and then let other people get into this conversation as well. No. These are all good questions, and Let me answer the second one first, because it's in a funny way, since it opens up the biggest question, it's the easiest one for me to deal with. And that is this question about, of course, you know, isn't it also, you know, about capitalist economics, and isn't it also about, you know, religion? And the answer, of course, is yes. Of course it is. What I'm trying to do is, I'm you know, it's hard enough in a course of 50 minutes to an hour to talk about the sort of the evolution in the past 30 years of, you know, American masculinity and where I think it's come from and what I think it's facing. Of course, this is the larger picture. And of course, these are the places, the ideologies, the political economy, ideologies of capitalism, the constant reference to biblical sort of, you know, norms, of course, the places where we go to for the authority, that legitimate the kinds of behaviors that we have. I'm not saying that that's not true. And so when you accuse me of being overly simplifying, of course that's right. Of course that's true. I did it on purpose. Let me answer the first question next. Is there a parallel term to feminism for men? In a funny way, I don't like most of the terms that would be parallel terms. I don't think, for example, what I do is men's studies. It sounds to me like men's studies feels like it's a reaction to women's studies. Okay, you've done this stuff, now it's our turn again. You know, you've had the spotlight for 12 minutes, that's plenty, thanks, we're gonna go back to the several millennia we've had it. I don't like men's studies, and I also don't like, you know, masculinism, because again, it speaks of a kind of defensiveness or reaction. I think there's two things. First, in the academy, I think what I do is sociology of gender. I think I use a perspective that has come out of feminist theory, queer theory, and multiculturalism, and the gender I happen to study is men, right? Now, but I think I'm a sociologist of gender. Now, politically, I think I use the term pro-feminist. Now, there's political reasons for that. I don't want to call myself a male feminist, a feminist man. It makes me uncomfortable. It feels sometimes like it's the cavalry. It's like, you know, okay, girls, thanks for bringing this to our attention, but we'll take it from here. You know, the male feminists have arrived. You know, that bothers me. It makes me a little uncomfortable. Don't want to do that. The other thing, though, has to do with feminism itself. It seems to me, now you're going to accuse me of oversimplifying again, but and I'm doing it quite deliberately. It seems to me feminism is really, really simple. All you have to do to see the world through a feminist framework is have one empirical observation. Women and men are not equal. And one moral position, they ought to be,
right? That's all it takes to support a feminist agenda. And if you were to disaggregate what constantly is called feminism into a set of like 10 policy issues, most American men, let alone American women, would agree with them. That's all it really takes, is a moral position that men and women should be equal, and the empirical observation that it's not. Men and women equally can do that. But to be a feminist, it seems to me, to call oneself a feminist, I think requires something else, which is the actual experience of that inequality from the perspective of the person not equal. I would no sooner call myself a black militant than I would a feminist. Or a gay liberationist. I may be pro-gay. I may be pro-civil rights, but I'm not of that group. And I think it's important to make a distinction. And partly I think it's important to make a distinction because this is a revolution that we guys are not going to be leading. We're the gentleman's auxiliary of this one. We get to take orders. It's not comfortable. So rather than search for that term, I sort of think maybe we should just call ourselves pro-feminist and be done with it. You know, they lead, we figure it out. That's why the list of names, it's like all these names. Who do you think identified all these names as issues that, you know, we have to take on? Women did. That leads me to my last point. If I gave you the impression, another place where I was overly simplifying, if I gave you the impression that men are running around this country completely confused, we have these old ideas of masculinity in our heads, but we're living in a completely new world, and what do we do now? We're trying to, you know, and my theory about this actually is that because of individualism, because we don't have a social movement for men like women do, because we don't have that, we have basically let men, the phrase I use is we cut our own deal with those four rules. Sometimes we're more like that, sometimes we're less like that, we cut our own deal. What feels comfortable to us? We all negotiate a relationship with it, but we do it individually. Now, it seems to me that if I gave you the impression that men were running around completely confused while women have it utterly, completely, and 100% together, I've misled you. Of course women are confused too. Of course it may be true that large, I get asked this question all the time. You know, how come, I mean, I'm such a nice guy, I'm really caring and sensitive, I'm everything that they say they want, and they all think I'm a wimp. You know, and of course it's true that women are confused about this stuff also. You know, just as we are. I would say there's one difference. They've been smart enough to develop a whole social movement to challenge and confront that confusion and transform it. We're still thinking we can do it all by ourselves. That's the first thing. The second thing is, let me illustrate that confusion to you. My favorite columnist for the New York Times several years ago, Anna Quinlan, had this column. Once upon a time, those of you who read the New York Times, once upon a time, the op-ed page in the New York Times really did have a feminist op-ed columnist before Maureen Dowd. And her name was Anna Quinlan, and she wrote this wonderful op-ed piece once, which I'll just tell you about. She said, okay, ladies, she said, I'm gonna give you a choice between two men. Now, I presented this a few weeks ago to my students, and so I'll tell you what their answer was too. Here they are, two men, you can have your choice. One of them is short, thin, reedy, strawberry blonde, thinning hair. He's, you know, he's kind of fey, very sweet, very nice, absolutely devoted to you, loves you forever, will never stray, will never cheat on you. He's yours and yours alone. The other one is tall, dark, roguishly handsome, unbelievably sexy, and a complete scoundrel. He will cheat on you. He has never been faithful in his life, and there's no reason to think he's going to be now. Which one would you choose? Now, my best student said, depends what for. She said, I think I'd like to sleep with number two but marry number one. I thought that was a pretty reasonable response. I said, okay, now let's give them their names. Let's call number one Ashley Wilkes and number two Rhett Butler. Now who would you choose? And of course, every American woman chose Rhett Butler, the one who never will be faithful, the one who's a complete scoundrel, rather than the one who's the complete sensitive New Age, circa 1863, New Age guy, right? Now, my student then said what I think of as absolutely the core issue. She said, yeah, but Rhett Butler's never been loved by me. When I love him, he'll change. And isn't that the defining moment of women's romantic fantasy? That women's love is transformative, it will change bad men into good men? So women are confused about this stuff too. They've just been smart enough to develop a whole social movement about it. So my feeling is, of course, it would be a fiction to pretend that only the men are running around confused. But women have been campaigning for equality as a way to relieve their confusion. And they've been demanding that the men in their lives also change. But of course, when confronted with the sort of fits and starts of that change, they're going to be a bit confused too. So I just want to point out that, of course, it's overly simple to just say that men are confused. The difference is that there is one social movement out there that's designed to deal with gender confusion.
Why not use the term gender? I would agree with you that we're all confused. And why not use the term gender rather than feminist to rally men and women together? I mean, you've even said that it gives you a strange feeling to call yourself, male feminist.
Well, so I don't do it. I call myself pro-feminist. Sort of, it doesn't feel bad to me to say that. There'd be a good political reason not to say genderist or gender studies, because suddenly women get invisible again. Then, it's like asking women's studies programs to suddenly become gender studies programs and not doubling their budget. I feel like, in fact, that, the whole idea was that women made it visible. Why would you want to then make them invisible in it again? I think we should just sign up and support it. I don't think we need a new term for it. Yeah. Obviously, I would find it distressing that women's studies programs aren't getting more funding and more, and obviously, it's quite distressing to hear that a program's been abandoned. I think that the function of women's studies is obviously very different than the function of many other academic programs. There is, of course, a there. There is some object of study. But it also serves a kind of psychological and emotional and social place for women to feel like they are visible. So I think it's absolutely necessary. The other side of it, though, is I don't want to see women's studies programs defunded, underfunded, downplayed. But I do think that we miss an opportunity if that's the only place where gender gets played out. I also think we have to start integrating gender into every course and every arena that we're working in. For example, let me just give you one example of this. If you were to take a course, you ever take a course in 19th century British literature? Okay. So when you studied the Brontes, right, all you studied were, femininity, marriage, sexuality, women, their ambivalent relationship with men, right? But when you get to Dickens, do you ever study masculinity? Uh-uh. Because Dickens isn't about masculinity. You study Dickens in relationship to class. Dickens is a social problems novelist. He writes about class, despite the fact that virtually all his main characters are little boys looking for authentic families, right? That never comes up, because we haven't integrated gender into our study of literature in that way. We know it for women, but we don't know it for men. We still study men in their public roles as, scientists or military figures or politicians, but we don't study them as men. So it seems to me that one of women's studies' next steps would be to integrate gender into everything else, not just adding women at the end of the course, we'll do 19th century British literature and then women. But rather integrating it in our study of male authors, of male writers, of male scientists, et cetera. You get my point. So that would be real fulfillment. Of course, it's distressing when you hear the defunding of it. Yeah, Ed. Not being a psychologist, I have no, I'm not sure. I think you'd want to know first some things about who the participants were. You'd want to know, and you'd want to start working with various groups on campus, if they were students. I'm not sure that, how many of them were students here, students elsewhere. There's various reports, I've heard all kinds of things that, the students came from all over to, let's go riot at MSU or something. It may be true, but it seems to me that there were certain groups that were overly represented at those events, and everybody knows who they are.
And there were some groups that are underrepresented at those events. I would bet you that the Campus Gay and Lesbian Alliance was not overrepresented at the riots, right? I would bet you that fraternity guys were, right? This is my bet. I could be wrong. I'm a sociologist. I'm prepared to be, you know, to do a little survey. Maybe I'd be wrong, but that would be my working hypothesis. So then you'd want to go to those places where people who were likely to have participated would gather, and you'd want to talk to them about how to be better losers, how to party without burning sofas, right? How to party in constructive ways, how to be gracious in defeat, the way the team actually was. You know, what ESPN showed was, you know, a whole bunch of people running around like crazy, but the team actually quite dignified when they came back, you know, and everybody had a rally form and everything, quite dignified. You know, athletes know that they can't, you know, that they represent the school. I mean, they actually have to, you know, dress up and act appropriately when they're on away games. So that's one thing I would suggest. Start working with them. Absolutely. If those had been black male students, if all the black male students on campus had gone, you know, and rioted in the same way those white kids did, they'd all be in jail. The police would have had guns out. They would have been arguing, you know, anyone of sort of liberal heart would have been out there going, don't shoot them, they're students, you know. But here, I mean, it's completely invisible. The race stuff, completely invisible, right? The reaction, again, and my argument, it had been women, the same thing. That would have been the only thing they talked about, right? Nobody's saying, oh, those rich white boys, you know, they think they can do anything. It's just like the suburbs, you know, mommy will clean up after them, right? No one says that, you know, but had it been black students, they would have said, oh, though you can take them out of the ghetto, but, you know, that's, right? All the racial stereotypes would have surfaced. But we don't have any racial stereotypes about white people, so that's what you get, you know, sort of, dot nothing. I think you're quite right. I have to also say there is an element, you know, I thought you were going to say something slightly different, which is that there is, I mean, let's face it, I don't know if you've ever participated in a demonstration or a riot or, you know, or even gone to like a Grateful Dead concert or something that sort of got a little out of control. It's sexy as hell. It's visceral. It's powerful. It sweeps you away. It's one of those Rousseauian moments when you sort of the boundaries of self dissolve and, you know, you become one with everybody else. And, you know, I mean, and you don't even have to have taken any kind of chemical substances to experience that at some of these things. And that's sexy. It is an erotic experience to sort of feel the boundaries of self dissolve and feel one with this big moving mass. So I think that there is, you know, not only when I talked about homosexuality, there's an eros to it also. Those guys are, you know, and there's an erotic experience that those guys are having with one another. Absolutely. The entitlement part, yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, that's a really important question, it seems to me, and it's sort of the one I begged in my talk. Why have men been so confused and not figured out a way to do it? I'll tell you just one little story as an illustration. I was talking with my students a few weeks ago about this, and one male student said to me that when he goes to the movies with another male friend, they always take three seats and put the coats in between on the chair in between the two of them, so that no one would ever think that they were there like together, right? Now I don't know if you know when women go to the movies, you take up three seats, but of course not. What am I saying? Homophobia. It's a terror that men have about really opening up to one another, about that vulnerability, about their discomfort with these sorts of things. The most common, most frequently asked question that I get when I've done workshops by women is the following question. It usually goes something like this. First, the woman will establish her heterosexuality. She will say,
When I'm with him, he's so kind and considerate and understanding. But then when he's with these guy friends, I don't understand what comes over him. He laughs at sexist things. He makes homophobic jokes. He says racist things. What's going on? And I think that this is part of what I try to argue in Manhood in America, is that masculinity is a homosocial enactment. That basically what we are doing is we're posing and posturing before in front of the evaluative eyes of other men. Starts with our fathers, but with our workmates and our school friends and our sports friends. We want to be men among men. We want to be a man's man. And part of that, it seems to me, has been a fear of being vulnerable and being exposed in front of other men. The answer to the question, now here I become an utter political pragmatist. If you want to start this sort of thing, you don't go out and design a big social organization, a big movement, but you start one person at a time. You start by finding, now, I don't know if you've read Solomon Asch's great experiments in social psychology, but Asch's experiments were, you know, about the power of peers and the power of social, support. My feeling is if you're uncomfortable with something in a group of guys, like let's say a bunch of guys are sitting together in that, you know, your group, and they're making some homophobic comments and you feel uncomfortable, you look around the room and you see who else looks uncomfortable. Just a little hint. And then privately sometime, when the two of you are alone, you say, I hate that. I don't like when we do that at all. Oh, yeah, we all sort of laugh and go along with it, but I hate it. And see what he says. And if he says, oh, I hate it too, then you have the beginning of a social movement. Because then you say, listen, I don't want you to bail out on me here. You got to promise that you're going to do this. But next time that comes up, I'm going to say, hey, cut it out. I don't like that. Now, immediately after I say that, you have to say, me either. Because, of course, if you don't, I get ostracized, I'm that sissy in the schoolyard, and I'm out. But if you say it too, it opens up a discursive space that other guys can walk into. And my bet is it stops that night. My bet is that you open up a space where other guys can say, I don't like it either. And suddenly you have that power to transform it. What does this mean? What am I saying? I am saying that men have the responsibility to do this work ourselves. We can't go to women and ask them to do it for us. It's not their job. We have to do this work ourselves, inspired, of course, by feminism, at least to my mind. But my sense is we have to learn to challenge one another. We have to learn to interrupt that behavior. We have to learn to support and listen to each other, too. There and there alone is the place where I consider the work of the mythopoetic men to be very valuable. Because I think that work is about breaking down the isolation and the barriers among men. It is explicitly counter-homophobic in that respect. It breaks down that isolation and those barriers. That's important. Because then we learn how we can really support each other. Then we have to take it out and bring it into the world in which we see that behavior happening. So I'm really very pragmatic about it. I think we change the world by stopping those kinds of behaviors here, right here and now. I've done a little in South Africa. Why do you ask? Well, first of all, when you say that, I have no empirical basis or experiential basis on which to argue with you. I'm suspicious when you say they don't want to change it, who the they is that don't want to change it. No shit. That said, so I have a feeling that there's it's not universal. That's my first, it's an empirical question. But the second one is I really, you know, it is true. There are enormous variations cross-culturally in the definition of masculinity. Just your comment alone ought to dissuade us from any biological essentialism. It's so different in other cultures. That, I mean, it's not like, you know, it's not just, their testosterone level's probably the same as ours. But gee, they're all different. You know, it isn't, masculinity is not like gravity. You know, it's not exactly the same in every place in the world. So I think that cross-cultural variation ought to tip us off that masculinity is socially constructed. and how it's done is within any particular culture. And that's fine. You're absolutely right to raise that cross-cultural comparison. I also raise it internally. What I've been describing is a very middle-class white heterosexual model of masculinity on purpose. That's the hegemonic model. It's the one against which all the other masculinities are measured. In my book, that's what I try to talk about, is how did this model become the model and all the other ones get marginalized? So I think you're quite right. We could do it internally. We could do it cross-culturally. I think it's important to do that. I think it's important both to understand the diversity of masculinities and also the ways in which some masculinities are arrayed hierarchically, one in relationship to each other. That is to say that there's one model that's held up as kind of the normative model. Oh, sure. There are quite a few people. Just absolutely. Yeah. One of the most exciting things that I did there was a conference on masculinity in South Africa in Durban a few years ago, and I met a group of men who work in the townships in Johannesburg, in Soweto, around issues of male violence against women. And they've organized themselves. They are themselves former batterers, and they have organized themselves into a group of men that do work among men. And they described for me the kinds of ways in which, you know, young women are treated in junior high schools and high schools. I mean, they cannot sit in school for more than 3 or 4 minutes at a time without being harassed by guys all the time. It's just relentless. And these guys are in the schools now challenging that, confronting it, working with young men in the townships. It is absolutely going on everywhere. The masthead, I don't have it in front of me, the masthead of Men and Masculinities has several people who are working on issues of masculinity in Japan, for example. There's quite a number of men who are doing that kind of work. So it is happening all over the world. Yeah.
Yeah. But part of the problem is that the nature of what you're doing, as you said, is making condensations and taking statistical analyses and making generalizations. I used a term years ago called generalization.
Uh-huh.
And if you're careful of generalization across the board to say that masculinity is a cause or somehow correlates with certain societal things that we observe. Okay, so just for an example, we lump masculinity across a whole broad spectrum. White men. I would say that, first of all, I'm fortunate in that having been in a certain era at Michigan State in the late 70s and early 80s, many of my friends never exhibited a lot of behaviors that would be ascribed to masculinity. Many of my friends are very, would be called Alan Aldish, sensitive, disgusting, both in groups of men and women. We also have gone to different gatherings. There are actually, people don't know in the United States, there are countercultural gatherings that do still occur. One of them is known as the Rainbow Gathering.
Sure.
Thousands and thousands of people gather, men and women, and they call each other brother and sister.
Mm-hmm.
And it's amazing how many of the standard things that we ascribe to masculine and femininity are gone. And there are discussion groups that go on, but people treat each other with respect.
Mm-hmm.
And there's also a key thing that we're not focusing on the past or the future or economic or other inequalities. We're all trying to strive to something greater together. It's an idealistic thing that actually causes a different way that we treat each other with respect. So when men and women treat each other with deep respect, some of this antagonism or labeling seems to go by the wayside. And so, for example, when I'm talking about different men, you talk about white men, what I think of is men who have been fired from their jobs or downsized. divorced men mm-hmm. who have health problems, serious health problems,
sure.
that's alcoholics. All those Appalachian men, those are all variations of men. And I would say that it's very hard-pressed to say that all of them also fall into a category. See, when we bump them all together, and now we bump the riot people in that as well. I have a completely different take on the riot. I've been in this town for 20 years. I will say as an observation that the primal instinct is that we have a seasonal need to actually have celebration. And we take that energy and we turn it sometimes destructive because actually we can't burn things. Human beings have for thousands of years wanted to burn things. Now this, I know it's not, I'm not defending the male prerogative to burn and be violent. I'm saying that both men celebrate fires. And if you see it in a peaceful place, which we don't see it anymore, but when you see hundreds of people gathered around a peaceful fire, it's a wonderful thing. And there's music and there's dance and there's a whole thing, an energy going on between men and women that are not violent or degrading. It's very positive. So I'm just saying that, that right now we're ascribing the riots now to another aspect of masculinity. There may be a lot of white men that are disgruntled in their life, and this is alcohol fuels it, and it comes out in this moment. I'm also saying that there are other currents that run through society, and that it, and that when my friend Randy brought up the idea of a single word for men, and you sort of kind of downed it and said, no, no, we really, if we do that, we're going to make women invisible, and we should really, you know, we should keep it focused on, like, pro-feminist. And I'm saying, I would take his point and say, words are powerful, and if we focus, we need to have a coming together at a higher level.
Mm-hmm.
So the words we use also sustain and create that reality. So we need words, I think, that do bring us together, and be careful of the words that limit us and create, like, the white man, because there's no one white man. There's a whole series of individuals.
Well, you know, look, I want to say two things. First of all, I mean, if I disagree with your friend, it's not like I'm putting him down. I don't agree that we need a different word. I think the word we have is perfectly adequate. It just doesn't mean that we're the center of the world. And I think that that might be a relief for us for a while. That's all. But let me just say something else. You misunderstand me if you think that what I'm talking about, in a way, is men. I'm not talking about men as corporeal beings. I'm talking about an ideology, which is called masculinity. That's the biggest misreading of my book as well, Manhood in America, is that there was one review that was really, really critical, and all the rest were positive. And the one that was critical completely misunderstood it, said it was a history of men. And men are so different, how can you write a history of men? I'm not talking about men. I'm talking about an ideology of masculinity. When I talk about men, remember, what I tried to say is men individually try to cut our own deals with this ideology. It's what we're handed. It's what we inherit. It's what we get in locker rooms and from our fathers and from our friends and from books. But my sense is that we're all trying to negotiate our way through it. That's a gender ideology. That's what's been inelastic. That's what's been hard to challenge. Not the fact that men are so varied. Of course they are. Now, so that sense. So I want to be really clear that what I'm talking about is an ideology. That ideology of white, heterosexual, middle-class masculinity is held up as the model to which all other men are measured. You don't conform to that, you don't make it as a man. Now, there's a wonderful passage in my by Irving Goffman that I quote very early on in Manhood in America, where he says that there's only one perfect man in America, and then he has this long list of adjectives in it. And of course, typically, you know, like I always forget to bring copies of my own book, so I don't even have it, so I couldn't even read it to you. But at the end of that, it's a long thing about who he is, you know, white, urban, northern, heterosexual, good complexion, weight and height, recent record in sports. He says any man who fails to conform to any of these, at least during moments, is likely to feel unworthy, incomplete, and inferior. Now, those words I do remember. And that strikes me as the thing that we're wrestling with. Here's this hegemonic version that's held up to us as the model to which we all are supposed to measure ourselves. And none of us ever completely fits the model. So all of us at some point in our lives feels unworthy, incomplete, and inferior. And I think that's where a lot of our actions come from, is that feeling of unworthiness and incompleteness and inferiority, and that's what all the compensatory proving it and bravado is about. That said, look, I know about rainbow gatherings, and I'm absolutely convinced that I have two things to say, one positive and one not. The positive thing is it's terrific that people that there are still hippies. I say this with great fondness. I graduated from college, moved on to a commune. Followed the Grateful Dead around through most of the Northeast for quite some time, and I have to say that I have a tremendous fondness for rainbow people and rainbow gatherings, and I understand the effort at gender equality. And I completely support it. That said, there is something else about New Age life in general that makes me uncomfortable, and that is the gender essentialism. And I heard it in something that you said. I didn't comment on it then, but I'll comment on it now. And that is, when you said, when I express my feminine side, this kind of language drives me up the wall. I think when I'm being nurturing and loving and caring toward a child, I'm expressing my masculinity. That's not my feminine side at all. I don't want to take all the good traits and say that's when I'm being feminine. I want to say that we have such a restricted definition of masculinity that I want to claim those as part of my masculine side. Everything I do is part of my masculinity, just as everything that, you do is part of your femininity.
No, you misunderstand me, though. You, if you think that, when I say that I'm sensitive, that I'm only ascribing my good qualities to my feminine side, you're completely wrong. I ascribe those to my good qualities to my masculine and feminine side. I only attribute certain qualities in a gender role-specific fashion because those are the language terms and the words that I
right.
have to describe them. Now, you can attack me on that and say that
I'm not
because I said my feminine side that I don't have positive aspects in my masculine side, but
No, that's not what I'm saying. I'm not attacking you at all. I am saying that that there is in a lot of this language a kind of gender essentialism. That there is a masculine space and a feminine space, a yin and a yang space, a Mars and a Venus space, whatever you want to say. And I don't buy it. To my mind, the empirical evidence is pretty clear that the differences between women and men are far less great, are far, far smaller than the differences among men and the differences among women. That those little... It's an empirical question.
Men can't have children, women can. That's a big difference. Many women. Women are the only sex that's capable.
That can.
That's a big
right.
difference.
But it what it means, you've described a biological difference.
That's correct, but that is something that well,
men are the only sex that can write our name in the snow with our urine. So what?
That's not true.
I mean what I'm trying to suggest is that is a biological difference. The question is not whether or not there are biological or physiological differences. The question is, does it mean anything in any culture? Does it mean the same thing in different cultures? The answer there, again, is an empirical question. I think the evidence pretty much is pretty convincing to the side that says, no, it does not mean the same thing in every culture. It doesn't mean the same thing to different groups of people here. Look at the first thing that somebody said. Well, yes, women can, but not all women do. Are they not women? Young women don't have children. Are they not women? Older women don't have children anymore. Are they not women? Can't have children. Older women can't have children. They've stopped being women.
What about sociobiology? Since you are a sociologist, how they combine sociology and biology would say that reproductive behavior
has occurred. Absolutely. And sociologists have had to deal with sociobiology in the 1970s, and now it's called evolutionary psychology, but it's the same thing. And what I'm trying to suggest to you, and now I would say I have some good references for that. Obviously, I don't have enough time to completely talk about it. I just finished trying to write about this. I have to say that I find the evidence for sociobiology and evolutionary psychology to be utterly and completely unconvincing. I find absolutely, virtually nothing in it that is convincing, particularly the notions that men have a natural propensity toward promiscuity and women have a natural tendency toward monogamy. That is the greatest just-so story of gender relations that I've ever heard. It's Kipling-esque. There's absolutely no evidence to this. It's like you find something in the empirical world and you read it back into some kind of mythic history. It's absolutely not true. We're not hardwired to that at all. Of course. No, it doesn't go the other way in every case either. What I'm saying is that there's no biological evidence. You cannot derive any kind of social arrangements from these studies of testosterone, from any of that stuff. The sociobiologists, their explanation for rape is, it's the reproductive strategy of losers. If you can't get a date and you have to spread your seed around somehow because you have to reproduce, well, you can't get it by seduction, get it by force. Now, that strikes me as a bit odd. You know, it doesn't explain, for example, how come so many rapists rape young girls who can't reproduce, older women who can't reproduce, kill their victims who then can't reproduce. I mean, it doesn't explain anything. My sense is that these are real just-so stories. But what I'm suggesting to you is that this kind of gender essentialism, this idea that, you know, men are from Mars, women are from Venus, I think we're both from the planet Earth. I think that we really have far more in common than we have differences. I think all the empirical evidence bears that out. And I think, frankly, if we were actually to look at a lot of that evidence, a lot of the things that look like gender differences are actually class differences. And that what we're comparing very often is middle-class women and working-class men or vice versa, that class and race actually turn out to be very big predictors, bigger predictors than we often think. We see the gender differences, but in fact, we're not, they're rather insignificant. Sure.
Having a debate with you and having you also here to listen to us banter.
I don't know if they enjoyed it that much.
Oh, I enjoyed it.
All right. Well, thanks very much.